Hello and welcome to another edition of Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons, and join me this week as we dive straight into the war zone that is Haiti. We then look at Harry Potter, Shakespeare and Molière updated, the return of Brando and James Bond, and all the latest British film news. It's a packed Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. We begin with a quite amazing film called The Ghosts of Cité Soleil, a documentary about two brothers, Billy and Haitian Tupac, in the ghettos of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. They're both in charge of gangs, fighting to take control of the slums, and they're both caught in the politics of the corrupt Aristide government. They're also both in love with a do-good French NGO called Lélé. This remarkable real-life footage, which even Hollywood wouldn't have dared to make up, was caught and assembled by Danish filmmaker Asger Leth and set to a score by former Fuji Wyclef Jean. I called Asger Leth, now back safe from the bullets in his home in Denmark.
Haiti's embattled president Jean-Bertrand Aristide has fled into exile and left Port-au-Prince at dawn. When word spread that Aristide had resigned, the capital Port-au-Prince descended into chaos. Thousands of Aristide supporters swarmed downtown today, armed with guns and gasoline. They torched homes and looted banks, stealing cars at hundreds of roadblocks and shooting at journalists. Diplomats in the capital say an international peacekeeping force is expected to keep law and order.
Asger, Ghosts of Cité Soleil is one of the most remarkable documentaries I've ever seen. I felt watching it that I was in the middle of the war zone. Lord knows what you must have felt like filming it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty hardcore film. I don't think you'll ever see anything like it. I mean, it's. I hope you're on the edge of your seat. I mean, that's what I wanted, you know.
I was on the edge of my seat for you, I think, as who's the camera. And I suppose in a documentary, that's the audience, the way that your camera is. I felt at any moment I might be shot and that we'd lose the end of the film. Presumably,
exactly.
You had the same fear.
It was a pretty hairy thing shooting this film. You know, luckily, I was not the only one. it was pretty hairy, you know, going in and out of the slum, but also crossing the front line of, you know, burning barricades and gangs, you know, on pickup trucks shooting at the car and so on, and then going up to the front line of the rebels, you know, and then back again, you know, this whole kind of scenario was pretty hairy.
But most of the time, it seems to me that you were on the verge of being shot by one of the gangs, because your story tells of two almost rival gangs, rival brothers. You gained the trust of both camps. How did you manage that?
I mean, they were brothers, you know, so, you know, initially they weren't that far apart. They kind of grew apart during the film. So the trust, you know, was more, we more or less got both their trust at the same time. You know, they were still hanging out together at the beginning of it and so on. So then they started growing, you know, kind of apart, and all this jealousy and hatred was growing between them while we were shooting the film. And of course, that became a little bit of a hairy situation because they had stuff, they had issues, and, you know, when they have issues, their soldiers, you know, their gang members have issues, and they start shooting at each other more or less. So, you know, it's dangerous, you know, you could end up, you know, getting caught in a crossfire.
I mean, talking of the shooting of the film and the title of the film, I know the name is taken from the ghetto Cité Soleil, but one can't help be reminded of City of God, or Cidade de Deus in Portuguese. That the look of your films has a similar feel, and the sort of the wild nature of these very young children who rule these ghettos with their guns. Was that in any way an influence on your film, or is that a reason for making your film,
no,
saying, well,
influence.
That's fiction?
I'm very inspired by City of God. I think it's a fantastic film. I think this film is City of God, but real. I think this film, it's much more, I actually think that my film is more dramatic. You know, I think you're more in the seat watching it, but I do like City of God. And, you know, I shot some stuff. You know, I've been working on commercials in the favelas in Rio, you know, and townships in South Africa and in Bombay, and Cité Soleil is just much, much harder.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because whilst I was marvelling at the images and the violence and the passion of these kids, I was also questioning the sanity of you in making it. Now, why did you want to make this film, apart from the fact that you got this very dramatic footage? But what is it in someone that wants to go into a place like that? What good do you think can come of it?
Well, you know, I know Haiti very well. I've been going there a month or two every year for almost 20 years. So, you know, I've always been fascinated with Haiti, you know, because I love the country. I mean, it's got such a strong history. It's the first black republic in the world. It's the first successful slave revolt in the world, you know. And now the country is just such a tormented place that goes through these cycles of violence. And it's such a shame because the people are not really like that. You know, it's only political stuff, you know. Going to the countryside of Haiti, you find the most amazing people. So it's on my mind and it's in my heart, this place. So, you know, I heard about Cité du Soleil for years. I've been going there for years. And then the last 5 years before I shot the film, it became a place where you couldn't go. It became too dangerous. All these stories about the gangs started emerging and so on, and that they were basically working as a secret army for the president. You know, I found that extremely fascinating, and I had a different take on how you could do documentaries, and because I have that different take on it, I think maybe a film like this can actually do something. At least it can create a different kind of awareness than usual documentaries. I wanted to make a much more dramatic film that can actually get a much, much bigger audience. You know, I wanted to make a hardcore, hip-hop, urban, dramatic film, and I knew that the story was there and that it just had to be told like that. You know, then you could get a much bigger audience and you can actually create some awareness about this place.
And you're talking of the urban hip-hop and the connection with Haiti. Of course, the most famous Haitian export are probably the Fugees and Wyclef Jean in particular, who you managed to get to do the original music, and he features in your film. Tell me about the relationship you had with Wyclef.
Yeah, but, you know, because Tupac, you know, this Haitian Tupac guy, I mean, they all name themselves after rappers from the States. Tupac, you know, is the main character of my film. He was obsessed with Wyclef, and if he could just, because Wyclef is this one guy, one Haitian guy, who made it out of Haiti and who made it big, you know. So he's not just a celebrity in Haiti, you know, he's more of like a beacon of hope, like almost godlike. So Tupac was like, if I can just get my music to Wyclef, you know, my life is going to change. So eventually he found a way to get in contact with him. And then once he did that, I could kind of, you know, contact Wyclef on my own after that and show him, you know, look, this guy who got a hold of you on the phone, he's for real. It's not bullshit. I have the footage. I can show you. So I showed him this stuff, and he was immediately, holy macaroni, you know. It was like, you know, I have to be involved in this film. You know, I would love to do the music for it. You know, if you need money, you know, tell me. And then basically the next day we went back to Cité du Soleil together, you know, me and Wyclef. So, you know, he I think it was a reconnection for him to Haiti and to the slum that he basically was born right next to it. And, you know, a way for him to help, you know, with what he can do.
Wyclef, we got 3,000 soldiers, man. They got arms, big arms on them. They promised us we will have security when we leave the gun. And after, the Weibo will come looking for us. What we're going to do? So we're going to die. Our family going to die. Our brother, our sister going to die. No, we don't want that thing. What we need peace, you know? We don't want to fight each other. So we don't want no more people die at Cité du Soleil because we die of hunger already. Why are we going to die by arms now? You understand?
Just tell me, Asghar, because I know that you mentioned that you had this connection with Haiti, and this is because your father is Jorgen Leth, is that right?
Who's
a famous Danish film director who then went off to Haiti to be the Danish ambassador to Haiti, is that right?
And
then,
no, honorary consul.
Honorary consul.
He didn't go to Haiti to become that. He was already in Haiti. He went to Haiti to because he's crazy about the place. He just wanted to live there. So he lives on the south coast in a fantastic place, you know, and he's there 6-7 months every year, you know, and
I see.
A title he has since abandoned.
Oh, has he? That's a shame, because I mean, I became aware of this when I saw your film, The Five Obstructions, in which Lars von Trier gives your father impossible tasks to perform, and I gather you were part of that film as well.
Yeah, I shot most of it and wrote part of it and so on. It was great fun to do that film.
A lot of vodka consumed in that film.
Yeah.
So you reminded you of that one, Asghar. Well, anyway, Asghar, I'm very pleased to have caught you as well. But are you off somewhere next? Are you off somewhere even more dangerous than Cité du Soleil?
I'm not an adrenaline junkie. I don't think I'll ever do this film again. You know, it was like you said, a moment of insanity when I did it. You know, I had the story. It was there. It was so dramatic. I could do this kind of thing with documentary filmmaking that I dreamt of doing, and so I did it. You know, I'm never going to do it again. You know. Maybe, you know, in another 10 years, another story that's equally dramatic, you know, jumps on me and I'm going to do another documentary. But I don't think I'm necessarily a documentary filmmaker, you know. I'm working on a Hollywood, you know, an American feature film right now. So.
Right. And tell me, has Lars von Trier seen your film?
I believe he has, but I'm not sure.
Oh, I wonder what he would make of it. It's something that I think even he would think was a little bit hardcore.
Yeah, I don't really know, actually, if he's seen it. I have to check up on it.
Is he all right?
He's been a little bit out of commission for a few months.
Yeah, so. He said he was going, getting treatment for his depression.
We
don't know.
I did see him a couple of weeks ago, but that was under different circumstances, so I didn't.
Is he okay?
Yeah, he's fine now.
Oh, good. Smiling
I think he's
again.
Fine and productive again, so that's good.
That's wonderful. We'll show him your film. That'll wipe the smile off his face.
Exactly. Maybe, it's difficult to find a depressed person in a place like Haiti where people are fighting just to eat. And maybe sometimes, you know, when you see this kind of extreme suffering, it makes yourself realize that your life is probably not all that bad.
Asghar, that's a wonderful note on which to leave it. Congratulations on Ghosts of Cité Soleil and good luck with its release.
Thank you very much.
Asghar Leth there, the director of The Ghosts of Cité Soleil, which is out in the UK next week. This weekend, however, sees the release of the fifth Harry Potter film. Remarkable mainly because the franchise still seems to have sent everyone into a frenzy, news desks included. There were bombs, floods, tennis and a new government, but no, the arrival of a new star from the Boy Wizard made the front pages and TV news quite easily. Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix is at least one of the best in the series, as it sees Daniel Radcliffe grow up and get a bit moody as adolescence sets in and the Dark Lord Voldemort threatens to return.
Fudge is using all his power, including his influence at the Daily Prophet, to smear anyone who claims the Dark Lord has returned.
Why?
The Minister thinks Dumbledore's after his job.
But that's insane. No one in their right mind could believe that Dumbledore...
Exactly the point. Fudge isn't in his right mind. It's been twisted and warped by fear. Now, fear makes people do terrible things, Harry. The last time Voldemort gained power, he almost destroyed everything we hold most dear. Now he's returned, and I'm afraid the Minister will do almost anything to avoid facing that terrifying truth.
Thus, the Order of the Phoenix convenes in a London terrace led by Gary Oldman, which is always a good thing. And new director David Yates does an impressive job in his first big feature, whipping J.K. Rowling's episodic narrative along and marshalling some spectacularly beautiful special effects, including a broom ride up the Thames, some gorgeous giants and a brilliantly miserable new house elf called Bridger, who really should have his own film one day. All in all, Harry Potter 5 is a good watch with some delightful touches and even some witty humour, mainly in the form of Imelda Staunton's Harrowden Headmistress. Continuing the British film theme now.
I'm at the launch of the Summer of British Film, a UK Film Council and BBC Two partnership to put British film back on the agenda. Throughout this summer, BBC Two and at the cinemas across the country will be looking at the legacy of British film. 7 films have been digitally remastered. I've just seen clips of Goldfinger, Brief Encounter, Billy Liar and The Dam Busters, and joining them will be Withnell and I and The Wicker Man, and they do look all spruced up and looking in their prime. Sean Connery's all-in-one blue toweling suit at the beginning of Goldfinger shines anew, and also so does a mole on his right cheek. The series examines film by genre, thriller, romance, social realism, costume drama, horror and fantasy, war and comedy. Following each programme on BBC Two, the genre under discussion will be showcased with a classic film in 136 cinemas across the UK every Tuesday night from the 31st of July. I caught up with the people behind the initiative afterwards at a reception in Leicester Square. I'm with Roly Keating, controller of BBC Two, who's given the British film 7 Saturday nights in a row. What made you decide to give it such a big swathe of your programming hours?
Yeah, it's not just 7 Saturday nights. I mean, right across the sort of months and a half, I think we're going to be screening as well some 70 different British movies across the channel. So actually, I think we've opened up more airwaves for British cinema than we've ever done in the life of BBC Two. I guess partly doing it for very personal reasons. I grew up loving British cinema, you know, right back to Magnificent Men and Their Flying Machines or the Carry On movies or the James Bond films. This was my life, really. And then about when I first got into television, one of the first things I did was a documentary about Ealing Studios, and I got to know, you know, that generation of filmmakers just as they were coming to the end of their lives and careers. And some of the magic of that has stayed with me, and I thought this is an incredible collective creative achievement, the cinema we've done in this country. And actually, we don't always take it as seriously as we should. We feel slightly as if we're in awe of Hollywood. I mean, rightly, Hollywood's an astonishing industry, an astonishing image factory. But actually, when you join the jigsaw, and it's a complicated jigsaw, British cinema, but when you join it together, it does add up to this incredible chronicle of our lives over 50 years. And it's full of vitality and idiosyncrasy and strange little threads and great talent and a surprising amount of sexiness and glamour too, which we neglect. So we just felt this is a really fertile territory. There are great stories to be told here. But also in a slightly more proactive way. I was half joking about the series we did called Coast a couple of years ago, where we took the British seaside, which everybody thought was kind of not very good and not very glamorous, and made them celebrate it and rediscover it. And in a little way, that's what we'd like to do with the cinema as well. Don't neglect British cinema. Love it. Enjoy it on its own terms. Love what's good about it. And in particular, if you can, you know, the chance to partner with the Film Council to actually get these films, some of them anyway, up onto this astonishing digital screen network where you can actually see them in all their glory, is a bit of a once-in-a-lifetime treat.
So now that you're at the helm of BBC Two, will that be will BBC Two come to be known as the place to see British films?
Well, let's see what happens this summer. I mean, this is partly a big gamble that actually there is an appetite for British imagery, British talent, British jokes, British movie making. And I genuinely hope it kickstarts enthusiasm, if you like, on both sides of the line, both among audiences, among, I guess, us as schedulers, but also among talent, actually the new generation of talent coming through. One of the points of doing something like this is to inspire not people just to go to the cinema, but actually those who are, I don't know, thinking about a career in screenwriting or directing or production design or whatever it is, to realise that although it's never been easy making movies in Britain, it's, you know, maybe, you know, every government tries to change the conditions, it will remain, I'm sure, a challenge to get movies made here. Nonetheless, we do a lot. The depth of talent is incredible. We're trying to say that the British cinema celebration is about more than just passively enjoying movies. Nothing wrong with that. It's also about realising that people, particularly in this day and age, can make them as well.
Well, I wish you luck with this. It's a very, very good start. And I look forward to seeing all of them and being pushed into the cinema to see it myself as well, which would be very nice. Rowley Keating, lovely to see you again. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
My name is Ricky Kelleher. I am the executive producer of British Film Forever, which is the 7-part documentary series which is really at the heart of the British film season.
Ricky, it's a quite a big undertaking here, kind of doing 7 nights of programming across Saturday night. What makes you think that the British public will get involved in this and be interested in it?
Well, I think they will. I think you probably know better than I do that cinema going is probably as popular now as certainly as it's been in recent sort of 20 or 30 years. And what was interesting for us was focusing in on the British part of film. I mean, film these days, as you know, is overwhelmingly American.
Now, you've managed to get a very impressive lineup, Ricky, in the of guests and talking heads, least of all myself, obviously, right at the bottom of that. But I mean, noticing the clips you've just showed there, we've got Richard Curtis, Richard Attenborough. And give us some of the other guests that will be turning up.
In terms of other actors, we had there's Michael Caine, we've got Kate Winslet, we've got Ewan McGregor, we've got Anthony Hopkins, Tim Roth, Bob Hoskins, people like Jamie Bell in the younger generation. Did fantastically well with directors, so we've got pretty well everybody we'd hope for, people like Stephen Frears, Terry Gilliam, not British, but you know what I mean.
I think he's honorary yes. Brit by now.
We've got Lord Putnam, Attenborough, Mike Lee, Ken Loach. Also a guy called Martin Stevens we were proud of, who's a child star of The Innocents, who sort of disappeared off the face of the earth, but
Jack Clayton.
He's an architect in Portugal, so
is he?
Him as well.
That little boy?
Yes.
Oh, don't they grow up nice? And he was all scared and everything. I'm glad to see. What do you get a sense now, and having put this together, and I'm only saying put yourself in the eyes of the viewer who's going to watch these over the next 7 weeks or so, does a British identity come out of there? What are the preoccupying themes of British cinema?
Okay, the clever
easy question.
Intelligent question. Well, I think social realism is a category that we look at. I mean, and I can't imagine if you did a 7-part series on the history of American film that social realism would be a category that you would, you know, it might be called something else, but I don't think it would really feature that highly.
Well, I think Flashdance has got a bit of welding and then a bit of musical in there. That's how they do their social realism.
Saturday Night Fever's got a lot of social realism. The fact that that's a genre in itself and contains some of the, you know, some of our greatest films, and I think some of the films that mean most to the British people, I think that says quite a lot about our cinema. I think that's really interesting as well. They obviously do speak to people, those films.
Maybe those are the ones that kind of define Britain, or like Britain pictures itself, how it would like to be seen, or perhaps through social realism. Ricky, just before you go, you've kind of been interviewing all these people. I mean, you probably didn't turn up to all the interviews yourself, but I mean, is there anyone that you met who was a particularly kind of interesting or colourful interviewee?
Kate Winslet was quite amusing insofar as at one point, and I don't really put this in, but I'm an old friend of Kate's, and I was talking to her directly and saying, well, surely you can find, you know, a couple of hours. And she ran through her diary with me, and it was amazing. I mean, just astonishing how one minute it's Mexico, next day it's New York, next day it's Australia, next day it's, you know, and it was non-stop. And you started to think, my God, you know, what these people's lives are actually like.
She really is busy.
You do imagine they're sort of basking. I've always imagined that they're sort of, you know, basking on a, you know, a beach in Bermuda somewhere and just deleting emails on their BlackBerry. In actual fact, they are incredibly busy people.
Well, I'm very glad that she certainly seems to have given you a nice interview, and it looks really good.
Thank you.
Cheers.
The Summer of British Film plays in cinemas across the UK on Tuesday nights from the 31st of July till the 11th of September, while the BBC documentaries British Film Forever start on BBC Two on Saturday, the 28th of July. Now, Film Weekly has its spies everywhere. Which unlikely British actor do you think was on stage with the Wu-Tang Clan at Hammersmith Apollo last week? Who do you think it is? Hugh Grant? Daniel "My Man" Radcliffe? Oh no. Let Method Man tell you who was in the house.
Hold on, my nigga. I got the first shout out goes to my dog, Clive Owen, in the building. You know what I'm saying?
Yo, Clive, and come out. Where Clive at? I need to see him. Where he at? Where Clive at?
Oh, shit. Yeah.
Clive Owen there, down with the RZA at Hammersmith Apollo. You can't hide from Film Weekly, Clive. In more film news, the world's first user-generated film now has its director. A project initiated by MySpace, which is something the kids use, I'm told, reached a climax of sorts this week as London director Vito Rocco won the vote among MySpace users, who will now also have input on the script and the casting of the £1 million project. Here at Film Weekly, we wanted to find out more about the MySpace movie mashup and the man who's been saddled with the job of bringing it to the screen. Vito, congratulations on winning the competition to direct the MySpace movie mashup. You're celebrating with some mash, I think.
I'm celebrating some mash, just waiting for my sausage. I'm in a fantastic original 1950s cafe in Piccadilly, and it's where I usually come for my inspiration and my tea, afternoon cup of tea. And it's a fantastic place to meet. And it's the great thing about it is it's real. It's keeping it real.
It's a classic British film location as well. I saw your short film "Goodbye, Cruel World," which was set on a South End beach, and I absolutely loved it ages ago. And I'm very pleased to see that obviously that the MySpace users liked it and the panel liked it, and they've elected you the man to take this kind of unique world first forward. I mean, you must be feeling some pressure on this.
Yeah, a little bit of pressure. It's fantastic news. I'm very, very excited, and thanks to all the MySpace people who did vote and all the people who maybe were on the wrong site and just voted anyway. It's great. But there's kind of a certain amount of pressure involved in making a film anyway, and it's quite unusual, I think, in this case to actually be having so much sort of pre-publicity around before the film's even made. So, you know, the anticipation of a great movie coming out, and then, you know, if I end up disappointing everybody, then I'll only be doing what I've done all my life, which is disappointment. But
your mum's going to be proud of you, Vito. You know that.
Well, I hope so, because I really, you know, try hard, and I just want to make people laugh a little bit and give them something else that they might not have seen. Maybe they'll be familiar with it. Maybe they'll be familiar with death. Maybe they won't be, like in Goodbye, Cruel World. But something, you know, try and give somebody a taste of something with a slightly different angle, a different source.
So tell us a little bit what it is. It's called Faint Heart, and it's about a group of people who reenact Viking battles as a hobby.
That's right. It's Faint Heart as opposed to Brave Heart, and it's a comedy set in the world of Viking battle reenactors, and it's basically a story of Richard, a guy in his mid-30s, whose obsession with Viking reenactments has taken him away a little bit too much from his family, his wife and his 12-year-old son, and she kicks him out, and he has to win back her love and the love of his son and bring the family unit back together. It's a romantic comedy, a kind of belated coming of age story, because he has to realise they have to put some of the childish things away and live as real men live, not as Vikings.
Have you immersed yourself in some Viking culture then? Have you been studying these Viking reenactments?
I have. I've just come back from the Isle of Man, where there was a week-long festival of Vikings, where a Viking encampment is built on the beach and Viking battles are reenacted from days of yore. It's a really a wonderful community that people are building together, plus a nice array of wash bags as well.
Meanwhile, the Edinburgh Film Festival has unveiled its lineup for its 61st edition, which runs from August the 15th till August the 26th. In her first year as director, Hannah McGill seems to have assembled a very strong programme indeed. Highlights include a UK premiere for Anton Corbijn's story of Joy Division singer Ian Curtis in Control, as well as UK firsts for other Cannes hits such as Gus Van Sant's Paranoid Park, Michael Winterbottom's A Mighty Heart, and Quentin Tarantino's Death Proof. The festival will open with the creepy romance Hallam Foe from David Mackenzie and starring Jamie Bell, and it will close with Julie Delpy's charming romantic comedy 2 Days in Paris, which is part Annie Hall and part Last Tango. Guests taking part in onstage talks will include directors John Waters, Stephen Frears and Mike Lee, as well as the actors Samantha Morton, Chris Cooper and Julie Delpy herself. For the full Edinburgh programme and how to book tickets, go online to www.edfilmfest.org.uk. In your cinemas this week are two modern treatments of theatrical greats, Shakespeare and Molière. When Baz Luhrmann brushed up his Shakespeare with Romeo and Juliet and Leonardo DiCaprio in 1996, he transposed the action to LA gangland. Now, another Australian director, Geoffrey Wright, who introduced the world to the bruising Russell Crowe in Romper Stomper, has given Macbeth a modern Melbourne makeover, complete with drug-dealing crime lords, nubile teenage witches and bottles of whiskey. Scotch, of course. Indeed, such is the effort Wright has made in placing Shakespeare in the Oz underworld that it's some relief that the school-uniformed witches don't kick things off with a "G'day, Macbeth!" This version, however, sees Macbeth earning the respect of crime boss Duncan after a bloody gun battle and being given the run of a nightclub called The Corridor. Back home, Mrs. Macbeth is every inch a footballer's wife and wants even more for her husband. Some details work. I like the faux Jacobean mansion and I like the Thane as Bono-type rock star complete with amps and guitars and wraparound shades. I like the drug-fueled hallucinations too, leading to orgies and prophecies and Banquo's ghost. Yet there's too much here that, to pinch a Macbethian metaphor, doesn't wash. Even though the use of synth music recalls Brian De Palma's Scarface with Al Pacino high on his own supply, this Macbeth is more of a spoilt child, and the most horrific butchery of all is reserved for Shakespeare's original text. France's great comic dramatist gets the Shakespeare in Love treatment in Molière, in which Romain Duris plays the writer torn between wanting to act in great tragedies, but alas, burdened with a gift for the baser arts of comedy. We find him bailed from jail by an aristocrat who wants to learn the dramatic arts to woo a countess, the comely Ludivine Seignet. Cue heaving bosoms, beauty spots, lots of sire and seigneur, lots of taverns and tankards, and people falling about with laughter at really not very funny plays, while Duris himself indulges in much hair swooshing and beard stroking while he falls for the aristo's wife, played by Italian actress Laura Morante. Some of this is witty stuff, played extremely well by its cast, particularly Fabrice Luchini as the hapless Monsieur Jourdain. But the film is saddled with two awkward bookends in which we see how the main episode is supposed to have worked its way into Molière's famous plays such as Les Précieuses Ridicules, Tartuffe and School for Wives. Consequently, much of the emotion is lost and the dramatic impulse dissipates as the threads of the stories become entangled rather than entwined. Hungarian film Taxidermia tells of three generations. A World War II soldier whose masturbatory powers include throwing flames from his penis, his son who becomes Hungary's champion speed eater in the communist early 70s, and, in the present day, his son, a master taxidermist who eventually says stuff it to everything. This is one of the strangest, most disgusting films you'll ever see, or perhaps nearly see, as I watch most of it through parted fingers, but there's no denying the technical skill here of director Gyorgy Palfy. There may even be some satirical point about consumerism and capitalism in here, but you'll have to clear away mounds of flesh, fat and fluids to find it. Strangely, one could say the same of Bernardo Bertolucci's reissued 70s hot potato, Last Tango in Paris, in which Marlon Brando butters up Maria Schneider in a faded apartment by the Seine. Like finding a copy of The Joy of Sex in your mum's bedside drawer, it's all a bit embarrassing these days. The sexual power play, the grunting and the cooing, and particularly Jean-Pierre Léaud's prat of a documentary filmmaker. But Brando is still a compelling, if preening, presence in a performance that hogs the screen and builds to a climax, and I'd never noticed this before, where he throws in improvised impressions of himself in The Mutiny on the Bounty, Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront. All of those are better films, but Brando is magnetic as ever. All of which brings this show to a close for another week. Film Weekly was produced by Paul Noble, and I'll be back next week with more on Marlon Brando. Until then, we wish you happy viewing.